Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Disruptions to international recycling markets have been widely reported. This led to conversations in the WCAI newsroom about how much of the waste we generate here on the Cape and Islands is being recycled. Our series, The Big Blue Bin, examines four major household recycling streams: cans, glass, paper, and plastic, to discover how much of what we toss into the Big Blue Bin is really being recycled and at what cost. Today, our conversation is about regional recycling. We'll be joined by WCAI reporters throughout the hour as we discuss the different recycling streams. We also want to hear from you. What's your biggest challenge when it comes to recycling? 866-999-4626. Joining us in studio is Steve Junker, news director and series editor. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning, Mindy.
And also with us is Carrie Parcell, regional waste reduction coordinator for Barnstable County. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
So, Carrie, let's start with some of the changes we've seen in international markets for recycling over the past 18 months and what it's meant by National Sword.
Sure. So, National Sword is actually a Chinese enforcement that they started with their inspections of baled recyclables that show up to port. For a long time, they were accepting bales of quantity versus quality, and a lot of our trash was winding up in the recycling. So a few years back, the Chinese government put down the National Sword, and now our bales are being inspected at port. And it really put a stopgap and a backlog on what is getting filtered through, what's acceptable. They went from a high quality, you know, list type acceptance level all the way to less than 1% acceptable. And that's just not a rate that we can, you know, feasibly make.
Do we know why China put limits on imported recyclables and what they were doing with all that imported recycling?
Right. So, the recycling process in China is quite interesting because you start with your large scale facilities that were really sorting out the bales and turning the, you know, materials into new materials or recycling it back into itself. The problem is that as those bales were being sifted out, they were going down to lower-end processors, and it was basically trash that some of the low-end processors were picking through. And then you started to see mounds of trash and a lot of litter and pollution in China, and so the Chinese government decided that they didn't want to be the world's sort of trash heap anymore.
So how have these changes in the commodities markets impacted municipalities on the Cape and Islands?
Right. So because recyclables are a commodity, it's based on a global index called the Commodities Price Index, the CPI, and it's sort of one of those things that's controlled globally, so you can't control it municipally. So when markets go from quantity to quality, all of a sudden you have to figure out how to get those materials moving. Mm-hmm. So when the National Sword came down, they stopped accepting the bales that were coming not only from the United States, but from other countries as well. And just to kind of give you a picture, China was taking about 80% of that. So when you have 80% of the world's commodities sort of just stop at the inspections of port for, at recycling rates and contamination rates lower than we can manage, it just stops everything. So when you're talking about that, it stops at the United States, it stops at your state level, it stops at the hauler level, the commercial level, and it stops at the municipal level when you have municipal trash programs either at the curb or at a drop-off transfer station. Mm. So everything just sort of stops. And then the prices go way up because there's too much supply and no demand.
Right. So when recycling really began in earnest, we separated the various types of waste. You know, one container had the glass, paper in another. So many municipalities switched to the single stream, meaning all recycling got collected together and sorted later. So what prompted that switch to single stream?
I think it was simply convenience, space. People liked the idea that they could put all the recycling into one place, put it at the curb or take it to the transfer station where it would go into a compactor, and then it would sort of go away. And where it went away to is what we call MRFs, or material recovery facilities, and that's when you have the hands-on sorting by humans, and then you also have conveyor belts and optic lightings and blowers and metal magnetized, and it goes through these conveyor belts, and it's kind of this big system. Mm. And as recycling is going through, it's being separated. So the machines recognize plastics and glass and color and paper and newspaper and aluminum and tin, and it sorts it all out. And then the stuff that's not recyclable or too small to go through will just fall to the floor, and that's your residue. Mm-hmm. And then that's tipped out as trash. And so they were doing that at a really high rate of speed all the way up until the national sort, because again, it was quantity, not quality. Mm. And so at these sorting facilities, they were just pushing through bales and it didn't really matter how contaminated they were. Now, sorting facilities, if they want to get rid of that and make a profit and continue to recycle and you know, do what, you know, the state has waste bans, they have since the 1990s. And so, you know, we have to adhere to that to be, you know, licensed to operate. Yeah. So.
All right. So Steve, when we started talking about recycling the series, there was a lot of talk of what we would focus on. So how did we whittle it down?
We wanted it to be local and we wanted it to be useful information. I think a lot of us were wondering, when I throw something in the blue bin, really what is happening to that? And so we started to think about, as a household, if you break it down, you have your household metals, like your cans, you have your glass, like your bottles and jars, you have your paper that you're trying to recycle, and you have your plastics. And so we thought, let's follow each one of those streams, at least as far as it's leaving the Cape and heading off into the big wide world, and try to understand how well it's being, you know, sent to recycling and at what cost it's being sent to recycling.
And we should say that this whole conversation started with listeners.
We did a Ask the Manager right. program here in January, and somebody called up and said, Why don't you guys look at recycling? And we had looked at waste before. We did a series of looking at the Cape and the island's waste and how it's managed. But this was really, we wanted it to be different. We wanted it to be even more detailed look at each of those streams, like I said.
Right. So let's talk about the specific waste stream, starting with cans and metal.
Our reporter, Haley Fager, did a report on cans and metal, household cans and metal, and we started it this way. Changes in overseas markets have impacted what gets recycled and how. But when you put a drink can or a metal food container into your blue bin here on Cape Cod, there's a good chance that it will be recycled into another metal product, WCAI's Haley Fager reports.
This is the guy, they're back.
The truck backing into this warehouse is filled with cans and bottles collected from transfer stations on Cape Cod. We're at the family pantry in Harwich, and volunteers here are standing by to sort this morning's haul of glass, plastic bottles, and cans.
The cacophony.
Jim O'Bara has been working at the family pantry for about 5 years now. He says the money from turning in these bottles and cans makes up a fifth of the pantry's budget.
And that was the first source of revenue, was sorting bottles and cans.
You probably know that when you buy a drink in a can, you're also paying an extra 5 cent deposit. Every can that doesn't get redeemed by the purchaser still has that value.
It's a great revenue source. It helps us support the pantry. Plus, we're recycling.
Most of the recycling itself happens at mills in the Midwest and Kentucky, where the cans will be melted down and made into more cans, or materials for things like airplanes or cars. Before they're sent to those recyclers, the cans have to be compacted and baled. That happens at a place like Mid-City Scrap.
We are not recyclers, we are waste stream diversion specialists.
Chris Kessing's an overseer at this industrial lot on the South Coast. Mid-City Scrap makes a business out of being the middleman.
A roll-off truck will come in here of aluminum cans, and this loader pushes it on the belt.
Basically a big conveyor belt that carries the cans up and then drops them into a chute.
And then gets made into a block, and here's other blocks you can see.
He's pointing to these dense cubes of metal, and they're only a few feet tall, but each one has more than 30,000 cans packed into it. There's another metal in your blue bin that gets processed here, steel food cans.
Campbell soup containers, Goya containers, chunky chili containers, it's all here.
There isn't a deposit for these items, but Kessing says this steel is valuable, and it maintains its quality, even if you recycle it over and over and over again.
The steel that's in that can could have been the siding on a great building where great things happened a whole long time ago that was recycled and then used to make a tin can, and now it's been back in the waste stream, and here you have it.
When it comes to aluminum and steel, Kessing says the value of those metals above ground is greater than the value of the materials that come out of the ground to make them.
Aluminum requires a good amount of mining and a lot of water and electricity to make.
So companies have a big incentive to recycle. And it works. When you buy a beverage in a can, 75% of that can is made from recycled materials, likely right here in the U.S. But the process does have a significant carbon footprint. Think of it. All of that metal has to be hauled around. It has to go from redemption centers to scrap yards to the recycler, much of it on trucks.
It gets kind of depressing after a while when you see the same things thrown over out over and over again. It's like, how many of these are out there? How many aluminum cans can there possibly be in Southeast Massachusetts in the Cape?
Kessing is sipping his coffee from a reusable mug. He says even though metal recycling works, he'd be happy if less people needed his services. For WCAI, I'm Haley Fager.
And WCAI's Haley Fager joins us in studio. Good morning, Haley.
Good morning.
So what was the most surprising thing you learned about metal recycling as you were doing that story?
I think the most surprising thing was just that it is a stream that is working well. You know, I think when we went into this, we were trying to figure out if the expectation met up with the reality of, you know, when you put something in your bin, does it get recycled? And for metals, it does. Mm-hmm. And I think that fact of when you buy a beverage in a can, 75% of that can is made from recycled materials, that was surprising to me.
Yeah. Does it matter if the cans are clean or if they have food waste in them?
You should clean out your cans, mm-hmm. clean out all of your food cans especially, and rinse out the cans. I think, you know, when those guys were sorting everything in that center in Harwich, even just for them, it's a much better experience if they're not spilling beer all over the place. But yeah. It's good
so
to rinse
metal out. Is one of the good news stories then in regional recycling, largely because it costs less for manufacturers to use recycled steel and aluminum than buying new. So as Haley mentions in her story, steel and aluminum travels through many hands and many miles before they are recycled. So Carrie, this adds to the carbon footprint for recycling. Do we know to what extent?
You know, aluminum is, if you use recycled aluminum, I believe it's about 70% a carbon footprint that you're saving by recycling it. The thing with aluminum is there's actually not enough of it, so they're still making it out of raw materials because the demand for recycled aluminum, we don't actually have enough manufactured to meet that, so we still have to recycle and create new materials for
That's
aluminum.
Surprising.
It was interesting in the next piece we talk about bottles and recycling bottles, but people are moving, more and more beverage companies are moving towards aluminum, so there are fewer bottles. The demand for aluminum keeps rising that way too.
Yep, and it's interesting when we talk about glass, there's kind of a fun fact for the state and what we're doing with glass currently.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. WCAI's Haley Fager, thanks for talking with us about your reporting. Appreciate that.
Thanks.
And we're talking recycling this hour. We'd love to hear from you. What's your biggest challenge when it comes to recycling? 866-999-4626, or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking recycling this hour in our series, The Big Blue Bin, which examines four major household recycling streams, cans, glass, paper, and plastic, to discover how much of what we toss into the Big Blue Bin is really being recycled and at what cost. In studio with us is Carrie Purcell, Regional Waste Reduction Coordinator for Barnstable County, and Steve Junker, News Director and Series Editor. And I had an email here, but you know, tell us what the next story is, Steve. We're going to talk about
bottles.
Next
story, we're going to talk about glass. And we had Catherine Ident, Morning Edition host and reporter here, take this on, and she tracked it down. And let's just get into it. We can listen to it, and then we can talk about how this works. I'm going to read you the intro here.
That's a good idea.
ever take a close look inside your fridge? That might be a scary prospect. But what's in there? A half-empty pickle jar, a few bottles of beer. Until last year, that glass inside your fridge was destined to come back as another container as long as you recycled or redeemed it. But when the state's only glass bottle manufacturer suddenly closed last spring, all that changed. WCAI's Catherine Ident has this report on where our glass goes now in our series on household recycling.
You have the top part that you can just place your bottle, can, or plastic into. It goes through, it breaks down.
Eric McMaster stands in front of a bank of redemption machines at T-Ticket Market, the liquor and convenience store he manages in Falmouth. The machines are designed to multitask. They can read the bottle's barcode, crush it, account for what the customer is owed, and what the store will be reimbursed. The machines are sleek, ever-evolving, and they're busy collecting binfuls of bottles and cans.
We do, I would say, anywhere between like 1,500 to 2,000 pieces total in the machines, probably per day, and in the summertime that drastically increases.
McMaster says the machines offer a twofold benefit. They make people feel good about helping the environment, and they're also good for business.
We do still have the people that'll come back with even the six-pack that they bought, and they'll feed the six-pack through and grab another one, and it just kind of cancels off their bottle deposit, so they enjoy that.
And when the machines fill up, the company that makes them ensures the bottles and cans are sent off to be recycled into new beverage containers again, making it easy for both customers and local stores.
Yeah, it's pretty quick, pretty painless.
A strong state bottle deposit law has made this situation possible, and it has since the 1990s. Brooke Nash of the state's Environmental Protection Department says the system captures about 100,000 tons of redeemable glass bottles each year, which until last year went to the state's only bottle manufacturer. But then that company shut down.
More beer is being packaged in cans, and so they couldn't make the economics work to keep this facility open in Milford, where our glass had been going for many, many decades.
Not a big deal for glass deposit bottles, which the beverage companies are required to recycle. Those now go out of state to factories in Pennsylvania and Virginia. But when it comes to those old pickle and jelly jars, they've been piling up. When the factory closed, recycling of condiment and other glass containers basically stopped in Massachusetts.
We actually have been stockpiling it in these containers here, which is all glass.
In Dennis, transfer station foreman Chris Contonio says at first the pile of glass was a headache. It's illegal to dump it in a landfill, and the cost to send glass off Cape for recycling soared.
So at one point when I first started, basically it was a wash.
Now,
people are paying in excess of $80 a ton.
But Contonio looks at the pile today and he's excited.
We're going to come up on the facility here that we built.
Soon, thanks to a state grant, his transfer station will become a regional depot for used glass and a host to a traveling machine that will grind it down into what's called processed glass aggregate. When it's finished, it looks kind of like pebbly sand, and Contonio says it will have a lot of uses for Cape towns.
It's not sharp, and basically you can use it as stone or aggregate to do drainage projects and mix it in with under gravel. So technically it wouldn't be on top of the road. It's going to be underneath the road, if anything, and it's only 10% mixed into whatever aggregate that you're going to use.
It will cost $60 a ton to process it, with each town taking back what it brings in. The facility is one of four funded by the state, and it's set to open soon. So far, three Cape towns have signed on to the program in addition to Dennis, and others are considering it. It's a solution to the close to 100,000 tons of non-redeemable glass Massachusetts residents recycle each year. But is it truly recycling? Here's Brooke Nash from Mass DEP again.
It's not a closed loop. It's not becoming another bottle or jar. But I don't know. I guess I'd probably say it's reuse as opposed to true recycling, since recycling typically means it's made back into another product.
But she says she's proud the state will soon be reusing the glass that goes into recycling bins because, she says, without the infrastructure to actually recycle the glass, reuse is perhaps the best we can do. For WCAI, I'm Catherine Ident.
And Catherine Ident joins us in studio now. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
All right, repurposing glass that isn't going to be recycled seems to be a good alternative to having it in a landfill.
Mm-hmm.
Do officials in Dennis predict at some point we'll run out of the use for the processed glass aggregate that they're producing from waste glass?
That's a question I asked Chad when I was in Dennis taking a look at their facility, and he doesn't think so. He thinks that because it's used in the substrate, it's underneath the roadbed, or any project, really. It could be used in, like, sewering, which is a big deal on the Cape, and sidewalks and all sorts of different projects. So he says no. He thinks that there's going to be quite a bit of use.
And you mentioned that when broken glass colors are mixed, the glass is considered dirty and not recyclable. But glass redemption machines take all different colors of glass that's required to be recycled, right? So I don't know, maybe this is a question for you, Carrie. Do we know why colored glass can be mixed in deposit recycling but not in household glass recycling?
The reason why is just because the clear glass has a higher value. So when you're a processor, you want the higher valued materials to be separated from the lower values.
Mm-hmm.
Again, with paper, which we'll talk about later, there's kind of the same thing between newspaper, mixed paper, and cardboard.
Mm. All right, let's talk to Stephen, who's giving us a call from Chatham. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, yes. I have a question about contamination.
Sure.
I live in a condo association, and we have a central area where we have a dumpster and single stream recycling bins. So I get to see when I get rid of our single stream our recyclables, I get to see what other people put in. Mm-hmm. And even though there are signs or placards right by the single by the bins that say no plastic bags, people put in plastic bags. Mm-hmm. And I know that gums up the works for the recycling thing. But also things like peanut butter jars that still have peanut butter in them. And as we know, you can't rinse out a peanut butter jar. Mm-hmm. And but so I'm wondering, is there a way to basically report?
Oh, I see.
You know, because I don't want to be the recycling police, but at the same time, I need to be able to point to some place and say, look, this is where it says no peanut butter
right.
or no this.
Right.
And it'd be nice if it was
yeah.
online.
That's a good question.
A phone,
yeah.
And not a radio show or a phone number.
Right. Okay.
Even though this is very helpful.
Okay. All right. Stephen, thanks for the question. Thoughts?
Well, Stephen, this is Carrie, and I work for Barnesville County. I'm your solid waste and recycling expert. And I might start with the hauler. I'm assuming you have a private hauler for the single stream recycling bin. I like to happy shame people by thoughtfully reminding people what can and cannot go out there. I'm not saying you have a lot of time to hang outside of your bin to do so, but I might start with the hauler. DEP has a recycling IQ kit, and they have some infographics on recyclema.org that you can access. There's info cards that people can put on the refrigerator. It's printed up that shows, you know, what can be recycled, what goes into the bin, and, you know, what types of items do contaminate recycling, things like food waste, which you mentioned with the peanut butter jar. And you can clean one out if you put a little bit of hot water in there, leave it overnight. Put the lid back on, give it a good shake, it'll come loose. It's awesome. but yeah, I would start with the haulers. And then again, you know, just kind of thoughtfully remind people when you are around, you know, that the plastic bags don't belong in the bin because it does gum up the equipment.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Katie, what was the most surprising thing in your reporting?
I was surprised to hear that when the one factory that produced bottles here in Massachusetts closed, that it truly was because there are fewer bottlers using glass for beer. I kind of thought that was anecdotal. I had heard that, and I thought, yeah, right. But then everybody I talked to said the same thing, and of course, all the research I did, you know, pointed to that. But then again, I also read some things too that as we kind of become more aware of plastic and how when we're going to get into that a little later, the problems with that perhaps there's some hope that glass might come back in vogue. But right now, you know, metal cans for beer is the thing, and that's really impacting kind of down the line.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to Dan, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I had a comment regarding beer. It's one of my favorite topics. It's unfortunate that it seems like we're really sort of moving backwards on this whole topic of recycling just when we need to be moving forward. But specifically, I used to go to Ontario, Canada a lot, like years ago, like in the 80s. At that time, all beer of every brand was sold in the same identical brown bottle by the Liquor Control Board of Ontario. And it was just standard practice. The bottles were returned and somehow cleaned out and reused. I think Canada has moved away from that, or I should say Ontario. You know, this stuff is all driven by marketing and advertising, but it's, you know, 30, 40 years ago, this was in place in Ontario, and we've been moving backwards.
Yeah. All right, Dan, thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts with us. And Catherine Iden, thanks for coming in and doing your reporting as well. And I have an email from Mary here who says, I've been told paper that gets wet is not recyclable, yet I still see people putting out paper on rainy days. Can't get anyone in Falmouth or at the company who picks the recycling up to confirm this. Please ask your guest.
Yes, Mary, thanks for the question. Wet paper is less desirable because if you think of something that's wet, it's already starting to disintegrate. So it's no longer the quality dry materials that you start to see. Just because something is wet, however, it doesn't necessarily mean it can't be recycled, but it's preferred that you do not put out your cardboard, mixed paper, or newspaper out in the rain or on a rainy day. And putting wet paper in with the dry cardboard at your transfer station or at the curb can you know, contaminate or ruin a load.
All right. Let's move on to paper, Steve.
Let's talk paper. Sam Houghton reported our paper story. When it comes to recycling, all paper is not created equal. Some types of paper are more in demand by recyclers than others. In part, this is due to a recent policy shift by China. And the local result is a change in the way that many Cape towns now recycle paper. WCAI's Sam Houghton has the story.
Inside a busy warehouse at Mid-City Scrap in Westport, a transformation is taking place. An excavator pulls cardboard from a mountainous heap and drops it onto a conveyor belt. A machine compacts the material, then squeezes it out like a giant sausage. And then it's wrapped in steel wire to keep it tightly bound.
That's our orchestra.
Chris Kessing is the manager at Mid-City Scrap, which sorts and bundles a lot of paper sent for recycling on Cape Cod. From here, it's shipped to paper mills in places like Canada and New York to be recycled into more paper stock. For paper recycling, Kessing says, it didn't used to be this way.
Just when we need paper mills, they're all gone.
About two decades ago, all this paper would probably have been recycled within New England. Then China moved into the market, undercutting prices so much that paper mills shut down. But in the last year and a half, China changed its rules about what kinds of paper it will accept, effectively shutting out deliveries from places like Mid-City Scrap.
I have more paper mills, the components of a paper mill in my scrap heap, in my stainless steel pile right now, than are operating in this area.
Now, Kessing says, those recycling mills in Canada and New York are having trouble keeping up with the materials being shipped to them. All these changes means it's become more important for paper to be sorted properly before being sent for recycling. A stream of well-sorted paper saves money for a town. Josh Pelletier is foreman at the Chatham Transfer Station.
Part of your job here as foreman is to shop around. You're looking to get the best price for the town. You're looking to keep the money in town. That's part of, making this place work.
Chatham, like many towns on the Outer Cape, has begun asking its residents to sort their paper recycling. Here at the transfer station, there are large bins for the three main types: newspaper, cardboard, and what's called mixed paper, office paper, junk mail, telephone books. There's still a market for newspaper and cardboard. Mills will pay for it. But since the change in policy in China, mixed paper now costs money to get rid of.
It's been getting $5 every month, it seems, that it keeps adding on. So I want to say last month we were at 50, the month before we were at 45. $55 a ton to get rid of a container of mixed paper can get pretty costly for the town.
Chatham trucks out close to 30 tons a month of mixed paper in the summer and about 250 tons per year. Once it was a source of income, now it's become a substantial cost to the town.
This is okay, right? This is mixed paper?
As long as there's not that little curvy ridge.
That's corrugated, I can tell.
And educate me. Is this
Paulette Feelig is on the town's waste advisory board, and she helps educate people about the value of this new business of sorting paper into the three bins.
I don't know anyone in my experience who's complaining about the decision. They're just having a hard time adjusting. Old habits die hard.
The town has been hosting forums trying to get residents to recycle better.
I think this is actually an opportunity for people to clean up their recycling. And the cleaner we get it, you know, this is what they make all that stuff from.
Back at Mid-City Scrap in Westport, those bales of cardboard are being loaded for shipment to a mill that wants them. But mixed paper, Chris Kessing says, has become harder and harder to find a destination for. There's too much of it for the mills to handle.
I'm talking, you go to a mill right now, and their processing plant is full, their storage warehouse is full, their parking lot is full, their parking lot across the street that they rented out from the strip mall, that's full. I mean, there is no leverage on my end to be able to say, hey, I got a load, what are you paying?
Kessing says the answer is to have more mills locally the way that it used to be. Then it would be less likely that the thousands of tons of cereal boxes, flyers, and other mixed paper would be sitting in a heap in a strip mall waiting to be turned into something useful. For WCAI, I'm Sam Houghton.
WCAI Sam Houghton now joins us in studio. Morning, Sam.
Morning.
All right, so what was your most surprising thing that you learned?
I think having, something so far away change
individual things here on the Cape was kind of surprising to me. I mean, we focus on Chatham, but even, a town like Mashpee, where I report on, they went from single stream just to having to sort out all their materials. And, it's not a huge change, but it is, something taking place in China. It's kind of interesting.
So how does single stream deal with the different paper types? Is it possible for them to separate the newspaper and cardboard, or does it just all become mixed paper?
That's a good question. I think I might refer to Carrie on this, but I think it's harder to separate out from single stream.
It is. I mean, the infrastructure that we have here in the state, our sorting facilities, our MRFs that I had mentioned earlier, they can separate it out because that's what your blowers are for. So it can kind of identify the weight of the paper, and then it gets into different bales. In some cases, you can mix all of the newspaper, cardboard, and mixed paper into a bale. But that's, again, you're sort of contaminating a quality cardboard and newspaper with the mixed paper. So you're going to get less value for that bale. So they prefer not to do it that way.
And Carrie, Sam's piece mentions that Chatham has started separating out the newspaper and cardboard to take advantage of the market. Are there other Cape towns or island towns that are doing that?
Yep. The town of Barnstable, the town of Mashpee, the town of Yarmouth is doing it. There were already some towns that were source separating. I believe the town of Dennis was already source separating those materials, as well as Eastham and Brewster. Mm-hmm. But the only towns that are still looking at single stream is the town of Falmouth, because it's a curbside program.
Right.
The town of Sandwich still has one compactor for the three material streams. But you are starting to see it more and more, yes.
Regionalization is a word that comes to mind when we look at the many issues facing the Cape and Islands. Would there be advantages for towns to band together when it comes to recycling?
Yeah, and I think they already are. I mean, they were pretty open. I was talking about universal signage using the Recycling IQ kit that MassDEP had created in lieu of sort of responding to the national sword. And what I mean by universal signage is that you don't have to do the same thing at your transfer station or recycle the same. The recycling all kind of goes to the same place. But you can be a town of Sandwich where you have two compactors, one for your plastic, tin, aluminum, and glass, and then the other for the mixed paper, newspaper, cardboard. But the signs would look the same as if you went to Chatham, where everything's completely source separated. So that way you can look at the signs and identify through imagery, where that material stream goes, so you don't catch yourself sort of confused when you're visiting a transfer station.
All right. Let's talk to Maureen, who's giving us a call from Aquinnah. Hi, Maureen.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
So a couple of things. One is that here on the Vineyard, we love to use newspaper and cardboard to put down to keep for, as a weed barrier. And then for people who suddenly want to have a garden but don't want to dig up their sod or a patch of weeds or hard ground, you simply pile the dirt on top, and within, you can plant it right away. And then by the next year, you can actually dig down through that layer that's by then decomposed. So as much as I love to recycle anything that I can, sometimes it's just great to keep it right on site. And the other thing I have a question about is liquid containers that have those plastic tops, like milk containers, soy milk containers. Obviously, you have to cut the plastic. Do you know what I mean? The screw top?
Yeah, Carrie's nodding. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So we always cut all that plastic part out, but can you actually recycle? I do recycle those cartons, but some people have said, oh, no, you can't. And the soy milk is like a triple layer, maybe even with a little foil in there, or it used to be. What can you do about recycling those liquid containers?
Yeah, so the cartons that you mentioned are actually not recyclable. That was discussed again after the national sort came down. The state actually sat down with our sorting facilities, and that was one of the no-no items. I believe they're referred to as Tetra Pak. If you're talking about like a classic milk jug, if you just screw the top back on, that's perfectly okay. The thing is if you put the top separately into the plastic container bin, it just falls through at the sorting facility and becomes that residue and goes into the trash.
Yeah. I think she might be talking about
the paper ones.
Yeah, I think she's talking about, like the almond
a half
milk.
Half gallon
that,
of milk.
They look sort of cardboardy and have a plastic cup.
Yeah, you wouldn't recycle those because of the material that it's made out of.
All right, Maureen, thank you.
That's a shame.
Yeah,
okay,
thanks for the call, Maureen. Appreciate that. Yeah. Brian is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Good morning, Brian.
Thank you very much. Yes, good morning. There's two points that I wanted to make. One was with the recycling, with China stopping, taking our trash and all that kind of stuff. Oh, that started like right after, they didn't care about, being the hub of trash. They,
The reason they stopped was because there was like a documentary on how when they're like children picking through their dumps, picking up all the recyclables because that's how they could make, you know, a couple dollars. The trucks were just like backing over the children and killing like dozens of children. You know, so they have this documentary about them accidentally just running over all these kids and everything and not caring. And then China, that seemed to annoy China. And China said, okay, fine, you want to embarrass us. And then they stopped taking our, that was like literally like the same month they stopped taking our recyclables.
All right, Brian, what's your second point?
And the second point is, I think it's a really good thing for us to let everybody know that with the plastics, a huge part about the plastics is if we could just get companies to make, just use like two or three or even four just regular, just the same type plastic. Mm-hmm. Because the major problem with recycling is that everybody makes their own type of plastic because it's they find the cheapest yeah. plastic that they can make. And then, you know, plastics can't even touch. I mean, I have a buddy that works, he fixes assembly lines. And he was telling me about this. He says, well, yeah, well, you can't even store certain plastics together. They just melt together. It literally chemical reaction and become a giant.
All right, Brian, we're going to get to plastics next. So stay tuned for that. Sam Houghton, thanks for being here. Thanks for reporting. And we'll talk more after a quick break. And you're listening to The Point. We are talking about recycling this hour, our series, The Big Blue Bin, looking at four major household recycling streams, cans, glass, paper, and plastic, to discover how much of what we toss into the Big Blue Bin is really being recycled and what cost. With us in studio is Carrie Purcell, Regional Waste Reduction Coordinator for Barnstable County, Steve Junker, News Director and Series Editor, and Sarah Mises-Tan joins us now as well. Steve, plastics, what's going on to plastics. Here we go.
Plastics. We sent Sarah Mises-Tan out to report our piece on plastics, and I'll read you the intro. We can listen to it. When you throw a plastic bottle into a recycling bin on Cape Cod, there's a good chance that it will head to a municipal recycling facility called E.L. Harvey in Westboro, Massachusetts. Where it goes from there, says our reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, depends a lot on what kind of plastic it is.
That is the sound of hundreds of plastic bottles, cardboard boxes, tin cans, and glass bottles being sorted on conveyor belts by machines and by people inside a cavernous warehouse piled high with recyclables.
Most of the material that you see here today came from municipalities, you know, throughout eastern Massachusetts.
That's Ben Harvey, president of the recycling facility E.L. Harvey. The process here is to sort out the plastics, squish it into giant cubes, and then ship it off to what's called the marketplace, where it'll be sold like a commodity.
Oh, they're just bales that weigh approximately 1,200 pounds. So it's a combination of all the different types of plastic that we keep separate, and then we try to market that material.
In the past, most of those bales of plastic had gone to China. But since the beginning of last year, China raised its standards on the kinds of plastic it'll accept. No more plastics that are contaminated with trash, for example. There's still a market for selling used plastic, Harvey assured me, but
the basic thing is that we've had to do a much better job on the quality of the materials that we package. So when it comes in all kind of mixed together, we have to do a better job of sorting that material out.
At E.L. Harvey, this means having to put more manual labor on sorting belts to pull out materials that absolutely cannot be in a plastic bale. About a dozen employees work to sort out stuff like plastic bags, plastic film, and just general trash from the conveyor belt of materials zooming by. He says these days, when in doubt, throw it out.
You can see a Twizzler package over there. Well, people think because they generate it in their home, it's got to be recyclable. That's not recyclable.
Closer to home, towns have also been making an effort to clean up their plastic recycling streams before they even get to a sorting facility. In New Bedford, a new effort has city recycling enforcers out checking recycling bins as part of a public education plan. Marissa Perez-Dormitzer, who's been leading the effort, stands on a residential street lined with blue bins.
So it's collection day, so we can see the recycling carts and the trash carts set out for collection.
Today, she and others are looking through bins and checking for recycling mistakes. If a bin is bad enough, it gets marked with an oops tag, explaining what was wrong. In some cases, the resident will receive a fine.
plastics we find can be confusing because of the number on them. Sometimes residents will see that number and they'll automatically assume that the item can be recycled, but that's not the case.
Many of the bins Paris Dormitzer looks in have what is known as plastic films in them, the plastic wrap that's used to hold together bundles of plastic bottles or Ziploc plastic bags that hold snacks or frozen vegetables. That's a big no-no for plastics recycling. She says things are easier if people ignore the plastics numbering system and just categorize recyclables by shape.
We're more looking for a container type, so bottle, can, jug, jar.
And bottles rinsed out with the cap screwed on tight, please. But even in the best case scenario, when the rules are followed, economist and environmental advocate Madhavi Venkatesan says plastic recycling is still tricky.
When you recycle a plastic bottle, it doesn't go back to a new life. A lot of times the recycling goes back to making thread for clothing. That's one of the most common uses today.
In the end, she says that isn't exactly recycling.
It's expanding the life of the plastic. So, and when a plastic ends up in clothing, which is in a lot of our clothing, it ends up in our water system through our washing of it, and it ends up in landfills when the clothing is disposed of.
For the everyday user, Venkatesan says recycling plastic starts with thinking before you buy. It's always better to use less plastic, even if you can throw it in the big blue bin. For WCAI, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
All right, Sarah, plastic is one of the more challenging items to recycle, starting in households, when it's unclear what plastic can and can't be recycled, to the facilities that sort and cull the plastic, and then the companies that melt it down. So talk about some of the reasons plastic is so challenging.
Yeah, I think plastics is so challenging just because there are so many different kinds of plastics and so many different ways that plastics are created with so many different chemicals. Essentially, you know, one of the biggest challenges is the lack of uniformity. And Madhavi Venkatesan, who we just heard from, she had me squeeze a number of different plastic bottles to illustrate this.
Do you feel how they're all different in terms of just the ability to squeeze them? Some of them, like the Sprite bottle, are really, really hard. The Honest Tea bottle is probably a little less hard. And then the Smart Water bottle is the thinnest. You can feel it. That density itself just tells you there's something different going on. And there's not as much thickness in the plastic, or perhaps maybe something different in the chemical composition. And so if we think about it, you're melting them down, then essentially you're melting down things that are similar, but they're not exactly the same. So that may require, you know, additional chemicals to be put into the process.
And if different plastic densities require different chemicals in the recycling process, you can see how it becomes costly, both environmentally and monetarily, to actually melt these down and repurpose them.
Okay, so there were a lot of who knew moments and comments in the newsroom when it came to this recycling plastic. For example, don't crush your milk jugs, leave caps on. So, Sarah, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about plastic recycling?
Honestly, I think it was the fact that there are actually people on the other end that are sorting through your plastic. That has been the most powerful thing for me to remember. And also just how much plastic cannot actually be recycled at all. I think in the piece they mentioned just jug, jar, can, bottle, and those are really very strictly enforced within the plastics recycling. And so, you know, there are people on the other end. I think for me personally, I used to say like, well, this looks like something I can recycle, therefore I will recycle it. And to just see that on the other end, it's just going to end up in an incinerator has been really powerful for me to know. And to also feel like I'm making these people's jobs much more difficult.
Oh, yeah. All right, let's talk to Nell, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Nell. Thanks for holding. Nell, are you there? Okay. No, Nell. All right. Let's type Brian. I don't know where Brian's calling from, but Brian, are you there? Okay. Well, I will figure out something. Maybe they hung up. We have Carl from Acushnet who said one of his gripes of recycling is the few types of plastic that are recyclable. And he says, just number one and number two in most cases. I wish they would make the recycling triangle with the number in much larger so it's easier to read. He says he has to put on his reading glasses to hunt for that little triangle.
So actually,
this was a big wake-up moment in the newsroom.
Yeah, definitely. The numbers don't matter anymore. That is an antiquated system. And the triangle really only means that it's been made from recyclable materials. It doesn't necessarily mean that it can be recycled again. And really, they are telling you to be very strict. If it looks like a jug or a jar or a bottle, you can recycle it. But if it's something else that maybe seems weird, just throw it out.
Yeah. Right, Gary, you're nodding. Yes.
It used to be with and doubt. put it in your bin and someone else will sort it out. Now is within doubt, throw it out.
Yeah. So it seems plastic is everywhere, right? All shapes, sizes, densities. So would it be beneficial if plastic was more uniform, Carrie, in density? Could it truly be recycled again and again as opposed to repurposed? And is that even a possibility?
Yeah, I think having some uniformity would help, especially with the markets and if, you know, these plastic producers and packaging. I kind of laid out sort of plastics in the industry. And as far as packaging, that's the number one use for plastics. There's about 146 million tons produced each year just for packaging. And again, not all plastics are created equal. And that recycling symbol with the number really means nothing. So uniformity for recyclable plastic would be an excellent, you know, thing.
All right,
Is there a movement to do that?
Yeah, we call it extended producer responsibility. It's starting to pick up. I think the tipping point we're starting to see is individual choice. So you're seeing like plastic-free aisles in grocery stores, and I think people are making conscious consumption now. So when I go into a store, I sort of think about what I'm purchasing and whether or not something in plastic is in a recyclable plastic or not. Mm. So I tend to veer away from things that are plastic, but not everybody can and is willing to do that, unfortunately. Yeah.
You always wonder, why do I need all this packaging? All right, Nell is calling from Falmouth. Nell is back. Hi, Nell.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. So this is a very important topic that you're covering. Thank you so much. What we have done in our household and also in our church community is try to go plastic free. Mm-hmm. We have a water bubbler now in our parish hall. We don't allow single use plastic in our own home. We're taking the Eco Challenge in July to go plastic free. We don't use the tiny plastic bags that you get in the grocery store anymore. We're buying in bulk with other families. You know, we'll buy 50 pounds of oats and then split it and put the oats in the glass jars. What has happened is that it's given us an awareness of just how much plastic is out there and how much plastic is used in all sorts of industries. So for us, it's trying to reduce the plastic in the first place.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you for calling and suggesting that. Let's get Brian in real quick before we run out of time. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. I was just like you guys are just talking about the making the plastic uniformly like across the board, like that's huge. Like just like the gentleman was like, well, is there a movement toward that? Like you can't even store these plastics next to each other because the chemistry between them will literally cause them to melt together and then they're just useless. You know what I mean? So it's like if we could get the companies to make, you know, more uniform, only use these certain amount, then it's much easier to recycle. And then there's a lot less burden on these guys at the recycling places that can't even let these blocks touch.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Because then the whole thing's contaminated.
All right, Brian, I'm going to have to cut you off there because we only have about a minute left and I want to let Carrie have the final word here. So, Carrie, you had something you wanted to say after Nell mentioned going plastic free.
Yeah, so I kind of did a little bit of research to find out which countries had the highest plastic waste. And the United States was fourth at about a quarter of a pound per day. Or I'm sorry, 3/4 of a pound per day, which is really, really...
per person per day?
Per person per day. And if you think of how light some plastics are, that's quite incredible.
Yeah.
The other three countries with higher daily waste per person was Germany, Venezuela, and Ireland.
Wow.
So, fun facts.
Yeah, so what are some of the steps we can all do to ensure that we throw away, you know, the stuff that needs to be thrown away and we recycle what can be recycled?
Right. So I did mention recyclesmartma.org. That's a website with a recycling widget called the Recyclepedia. So if you have a question or a concern or thought about what can be recycled or whether or not it needs to go in the trash, the bin, or be recycled somewhere else, like a textile, which is clothing. Mm-hmm. Textiles are recyclable, but you can't put it in your bin because of the tangling factor at the sorting facilities. But you can take your textiles to a textile collection to be recycled. So there's different ways that items that don't go in the bin do get recycled, but we're really focused on that bin, you know, the top 10 in the bin, the basics.
Yeah. All right, we will have links to Recycle Smart Mass and the Recycling IQ kits at our website, capeandislands.org. We can also listen to all of the stories in our Big Blue Bin series again. Also see a short video with tips on how to recycle. Sarah Mises-Tan, Steve Junker, Carrie Purcell, Regional Waste Reduction Coordinator for Barnstable County. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.